Today is Thursday, the 22nd of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Turkey says it's in negotiations to secure the Kabul airport after the U.S. withdrawals from Afghanistan.
Ankara is banking on its historical ties with Afghanistan and its status as NATO's only predominantly Muslim member to help ease Taliban opposition.
Plus, U.S. Republicans threaten to boycott a Democratic Party-led committee investigating the January 6th riot at the Capitol building after Speaker Nancy Pelosi refuses to sit some lawmakers. We'll have these stories and more next. Turkey says it's going ahead with its plans to take over security at the Kabul International Airport after the pullout of U.S. troops despite opposition from the Taliban. Ankara is in negotiations with Washington to secure the airport, which analysts say is key to maintaining stability and an international presence in Afghanistan. Dorian Jones starts us off.
The Taliban has warned Turkey of severe consequences if its military remains in Afghanistan when other foreign forces pull out. But Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in remarks this week, appeared to play down those threats and indicated negotiations would continue.
Şu an itibariyle gerek dışişleri nezdinde.
Erdogan said, whether at the level of the foreign ministry or at his level, Turkey is trying to see what kind of talks it can hold with the Taliban and where these talks can take them. Ankara is banking on its historical ties with Afghanistan and its status as NATO's only predominantly Muslim member to help ease Taliban opposition. The 500-person Turkish force in Afghanistan has also avoided any military confrontation with the Taliban. However, Hussein Baja, head of the Ankara-based Foreign Affairs Institute, who has recently returned from the region, warned Ankara is overestimating its position.
Any Turkish participation concerning the airport would be disastrous for Turkish foreign policy. Taliban, they stated they don't like Tayyip Erdogan and they don't like Turkey's military presence. Taliban is very determined to kick out all the forces. Turkey's presence there is definitely unwanted.
Turkey is continuing discussions with Washington over the airport mission. Both sides describe the talks as productive. Relations between the NATO members have been deeply strained, especially over Ankara's deepening ties with Moscow. İlhan Özgel, economist for the Duvar news portal, says Ankara sees the Kabul airport mission as key to repairing relations with Washington.
The most important thing is that the AKP government is trying to fix the ties with the Biden administration and they want to offer something good for them. Ankara is trying to prove that this is a very good ally, it's a precious ally that they cannot be lost and they cannot be ignored.
Turkey is looking to its close allies, Pakistan and Qatar, which some observers say have close relations with the Taliban, to overcome opposition from the group. But Baja warns that with the Taliban believing it's on the verge of assuming power, the importance of those countries is diminishing.
Taliban does not consider Pakistan and Qatar and Turkey as the countries which should be on the priority list. No, they are not. Politically speaking, Russia, China and America. Maybe India to a certain degree. Taliban say we establish our state, then we negotiate.
With only a matter of weeks left before the pullout of American forces is complete, analyst Özgel warns if the Taliban maintains its opposition, Ankara could find itself trapped.
If Turkey insists on maintaining troops there after the withdrawal of NATO, which has already happened, that would be a risk. If Turkey concedes to Taliban's recent statement, that would be a humiliation for Turkey.
With Ankara having little leverage over the Taliban, Özgel suggests a last-minute collapse in U.S.-Turkish talks over the airport operation could provide a face-saving option for Ankara, but at a cost to bilateral ties. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
As the security situation in Afghanistan deteriorates, so does the situation for all of the other gains the country has made during the past 20 years. One of them is a free press. Afghanistan went from zero independent media to 170 radio stations. Now, they're in jeopardy. Aisha Tanzim is up next.
In Afghanistan, district after district is falling to the Taliban. The militant group has more than doubled the territory it controls in the last 3 months. A very public casualty of this takeover, freedom of the press. Nearly 50 journalists fled to safety, fearing for their lives. More than 20 media outlets have stopped operating. Others are forced to broadcast Taliban propaganda. Najib Sharifi is the director of the Afghan Journalists Safety Committee.
We have at least 5 media stations, private media outlets, that have been taken over by the Taliban. And through these 5 stations, Taliban broadcast their propaganda. They have also stopped broadcasting of music and voices of women.
We only took over radio stations run by the Kabul government. Since they were government-owned and we replaced that government, but private radio stations are allowed to operate. We have told journalists to operate them normally.
Taliban denials and reassurances seem to be falling on deaf ears. Local journalists continue to flee as Taliban approach. 4 VOA reporters have left their homes for the safety of capital Kabul. Pictures and some videos are all they now have of their life and work back home. Lina Shirzad had been receiving threats from unknown people. As a female journalist, her work was twice as hard.
I received a lot of threats recently, even death threats. They told me to stop working in the media, but I continued. I never expected that the Taliban would surround my hometown, and I won't be able to work as a journalist anymore.
Afghanistan was already one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. Last week, Pulitzer Prize-winning Reuters photographer Danish Siddiqui was killed in fighting. With the Taliban advances, entire districts have turned into news black holes. No one is verifying accusations of human rights violations from any side. And no one can verify claims of good governance by the Taliban either. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
On Wednesday, U.S. Agency for Global Media acting CEO Kelu Chow called the targeting of journalists' private conversations in any way unconscionable. This is after an investigation by several media organizations found a spyware was being used to try and hack into the smartphones belonging to journalists, human rights activists, business executives, and government officials. Some 180 journalists, including some from Voice of America and sister network Radio Free Europe Radio Liberté, appear to have been targeted. The spyware tool called Pegasus was developed by Israeli company NSO Group. Chow added, "This abuse must stop, and reporters' security must be protected." You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Jordan's King Abdullah was the first Arab leader to visit the Biden White House, and analysts say the visit helped in resetting relations with Jordan, a key Middle East ally for Washington, shaken during former President Donald Trump's tenure. Dale Gavlak has that story.
Bruce Riddell, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, tells VOA that numerous meetings between King Abdullah and top U.S. officials are taking place to underscore American support, not just for Jordan, but its moderate ruler and his position. Abdullah, traditionally a key broker on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, increasingly found his position squeezed by the Trump administration's so-called deal of the century, observers say, because the arrangement did not include a two-state solution to the conflict. Jordan also found its role as the custodian of Muslim and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem undercut by former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Then there were domestic and regional issues complicating the equation. In April, a royal aide, an envoy, and the king's half-brother, Prince Hamza, were accused of an alleged plot with Saudi Arabia to overthrow Abdullah. Bruce Riddell comments.
It's very much relationship after the very difficult Trump years, then there has been added urgency to the need to reboot the relationship by the discovery of the conspiracy this spring. The Jordanians don't want to publicly discuss the role of the Saudis in supporting the conspiracy, but it's got to be an issue of acute concern for them. And it should be an area of acute concern for Americans, too. One American ally trying to destabilize another American ally is not helpful and is very dangerous.
Meanwhile, U.S. academic Curtis Ryan, who focuses on Jordan, told Dubai's The National Newspaper that Jordan and its partners see the new three-way alignment or axis with Iraq and Egypt as an alternative power center in Arab politics that helps to bring non-Gulf voices back to the forefront of Arab politics. In the past, the trio worked as a united front in dealing with Gulf allies over aid, oil, and investment, he said. Riddell pointed to the July 18 visit by Abdullah and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to Baghdad as a positive step to limit Iranian influence there.
The king has been the most energetic Arab leader by far in trying to support a stable Iraqi government. This summit in Baghdad of Iraq, Jordan, and Egypt is the first time the Sunni Arabs have ever really done anything, 18 years since the fall of Saddam, that they've actually done something to try to not only stabilize Iraq, but also to offset Iranian influence. They have notoriously, particularly the Saudis, done so very little there.
Riddell says both the U.S. and Jordan want American troops to stay available, particularly in that triangle where Jordan, Iraq, and Syria come together to provide stability there. Analysts also think that Jordan could house U.S. troops after they withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan. Jordan made public a defense agreement with the U.S. in March that permits free entry of American forces, aircraft, and vehicles into the kingdom. Dale Geflack for VOA News, Amman.
House Republicans are threatening to boycott a committee investigating the riot at the U.S. Capitol building. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has those details.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is rejecting two of the five Republicans Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy named to the panel, Trump allies Jim Banks and Jim Jordan.
It's an egregious abuse of power. Pelosi has broken this institution.
McCarthy says unless she seats all five, Republicans will not take part and instead will do their own probe. Pelosi cited the investigation's integrity in rejecting Banks and Jordan, who both voted to overturn Joe Biden's presidential win hours after the January 6th insurrection. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Tanzania's main opposition party, the Party for Democracy and Progress, which is also known as Chadema, says that their leader, Freeman Mbowe, was arrested before he was scheduled to speak at a conference to announce demands for constitutional reforms. Charles Combi has more.
The statement from Chadema's communication director, John Mrema, shared on Twitter, says Freeman Mbowe and 10 other Chadema members were rounded up at night in Tanzania's northwestern port city of Mwanza. The party condemns the repression of the rights of Tanzanians with the strongest force. These are the signs that the dictatorship that existed during the rule of President John Magufuli continues, the statement said. Mbowe was approached by an army of police officers in his hotel when he arrived at 2:30 a.m. Wednesday and was arrested together with other leaders of the party, according to the local reports. While other Chadema members were taken to Mwanza police station, there has been no information about Mbowe's whereabouts so far. We want the police to come out and say where the chairman is and why he was arrested, the opposition party statement said. The deputy chairperson of Chadema, Tundu Lissu, pleaded for action in support of the country's civil society. Calling for political reforms is no breach of any law, he said. Lissu said that he urges Tanzania's development partners to stop subsidizing the CCM dictatorship and to support democracy in a Twitter post Wednesday. The Chama cha Mapinduzi is the country's ruling party and the second longest ruling party on the continent. On Monday, Mbowe said the party will not leave the city until the new constitution conference takes place, telling the government if it intends to prevent them from organizing the conference, they should enhance their skills to fight the people. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Nigerian authorities say that they have secured the release of 100 people abducted by bandits last month in northwest Zamfara state and without paying any ransom. Timothy Abizu speaks to security analysts about the claim and the significance of their release.
80 out of the 100 rescued victims were present during a media briefing in Zamfara state Tuesday and soon afterward allowed to return home. Authorities said the remaining 20 were very sick and being closely monitored. Police command spokesperson Shehu Mohammed said during the briefing that their release was, quote, unconditional, end quote, and was secured, quote, without giving any financial or material gain, end quote, to bandits. But security analyst Darlington Abdullahi says the chances of releasing abductees without ransom are very slim.
The kidnapping for ransom, it has been a means for them to survive. Strangely enough, you know, they have also found out that they will make more money from the kidnapping. Even though the risks are high, but they are, that's why they are equally well-armed, you know, and ready to deal with anybody that comes their way.
Since December, ransom-seeking armed groups have increasingly kidnapped people across Nigeria's northern states, exacerbating a dire security situation in the region long afflicted by the Boko Haram insurgency and clashes over scarce resources and grazing lands. Bandits often demand ransoms ranging between $500 and $100,000 or more, depending on the victims and their families. Security analyst Lawrence Alobi says he supports the government's stance, citing increased military action that is decimating criminal gangs in Zamfara state.
If the government says they didn't pay ransom to the kidnappers, I don't think it is necessary for us to begin to jump issues.
Nigerian authorities have strongly opposed ransom payments to bandits and even moved to outlaw the practice by criminalizing offenders. The Nigerian Air Force said its operations in Zamfara and Kaduna have neutralized hundreds of bandits in recent weeks. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
At least 25 people are dead in China's central Henan province after massive floods triggered by several days of heavy rains. There are three more days of rains predicted. Dozens of reservoirs and dams have reached critical levels, with local authorities warning that the Yihitan Dam in the nearby city of Luoyang had sustained a 20-meter breach and was on the verge of imminent collapse. Authorities have evacuated 100,000 residents to safe zones. A person allegedly involved in a high-profile Twitter hack last July has been arrested in Spain. British citizen Joseph O'Connor allegedly participated in the hijacking of more than 130 verified accounts, including those of SpaceX's Elon Musk, former U.S. President Barack Obama, and current President Joe Biden, to ask for Bitcoin. O'Connor is also suspected of taking control of TikTok and Snapchat accounts and cyberstalking. Water shortage protests and drought-plagued southwestern Iran appear to have spread to more cities and taken on a sharper anti-government tone as the unrest extended into a sixth night. The arrest initially erupted in Khuzestan late Thursday and turned deadly the next evening when Iranian state media reported the killings of two men by gunfire during the demonstrations. The Philippines Supreme Court ruled in March but made the decision public Wednesday that the International Criminal Court can prosecute government actors for alleged crimes before the nation withdrew from the court. President Rodrigo Duterte says that he will not cooperate with the ICC probes and believes that the court has no jurisdiction. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. It's not uncommon to see people carrying bags to schools, offices, and to and from retail and grocery stores. But perhaps you could argue that's also a new trend because some of these bags are being made from 100% recyclable materials. In Uganda, Ori Bags Innovations Limited is one of the leading manufacturers of eco-friendly paper bags and is turning various forms of waste into valuable products. For more, Africa 54's Paul Ndiho spoke to Rusia Orichiza, the CEO of Oribags Innovations in Kampala, Uganda, via Skype.
Came up with this incredible idea back in the day, and now you are one of the leading producers of paper bags in Uganda. Tell me a little bit more about your innovations.
At Oribags, we do ecologically recover agricultural wastes, office waste, to make packaging materials in different sizes, colors, and shapes. And we mainly specialize in two lines, one in gift bags and the second one in gift boxes.
You talked about agriculture and office recyclables. So what's that? What are you talking about?
We work with the different sperm suppliers where we use cotton waste. Mainly, it is the leading waste that we use. Yes, we also, when we're still under incubation at the Uganda Industrial Research, we experimented different wastes and fibers. But because of the cost implication, we only concentrated on cotton waste. So that's what we mainly use. We turn it around. We make different grammages of paper, which we convert into gift bags. And the office waste, we use it for making straw board, which is the line for making gift boxes.
How did you get started? Where did you get this idea of converting a raw cotton or a recyclable cotton into beautiful paper bags?
As a student, I was at the university, and I used to make jewelry products for my fellow students, lecturers, and the people whom I used to approach to sell my beaded products. So later, it became a business for everyone. I was no longer profiting from it. So having been a reader at the university, I approached the Uganda Industrial Research Institute with my idea to be supported to develop a good, competent product. So through different interactions and the first buyers that we supplied, we put in consideration their feedback. So that's where we were in position to only concentrate on the cost-effective fibers that could be used to make different packaging materials.
When I first met you a couple years ago, you are like really struggling. Now you tell me you've moved on. You own a facility. Congratulations on that. What are you able to do at that facility now?
Definitely, it has been an exciting and challenging journey for me and my team at Oribags. So now we have our own home, yes, which is on Mitiana Road, a few kilometers from the main city center, where we have mainly all the departments, production facility. We have their product development facility and all the core departments that matter in our business.
In terms of employment, how many people do you employ at your factory?
Currently, we are a team of 26 permanent employees at Oribags, and these are under departments of production, product development, administration, sales and marketing. Then we also have research and development, and then security. So that's how we are categorized now.
In terms of sales, in terms of volumes, how much are you able to produce a month, or how much goes out and is supplied to your clients?
Currently, for the line of gift boxes, in a month we are in a position to produce over 150,000 boxes per month. And these go to corporate companies and gift dealers. We have worked with several SME owners, small and medium entrepreneurs. Under this, we have also like those university graduates that have done internship at our factory. They have taken on new business lines. Some are our distributors, wholesalers. So for us, as we are not doing this alone. We are doing this in partnership with our buyers, our retailers, and our wholesalers.
That was Rusia Orichiza, the CEO of Oribags Innovations in Kampala, Uganda, speaking to Africa 54's Paul Ndiho. The 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games officially began on Wednesday, although the opening ceremony isn't until Friday. The Japanese women's softball team posted an 8-1 rout of Australia, and the U.S. women's team suffered a shocking 3-0 defeat to Sweden. As the games finally do get underway, the pandemic has also forced the organizers to forgo many Olympic traditions. Bill Gallo reports that the changes may also impact fan interest.
The medal presentation ceremony is usually one of the most iconic Olympic moments, when victorious athletes bow their heads to receive medals. But at the Tokyo Olympics, which start Friday, athletes will be presented medals on a tray. They will then hang the medals on their own necks. The do-it-yourself medal ceremony is just one way the Summer Olympics will look different this year. There will also be cavernous empty stadiums, a prohibition on athlete high fives and hugs, and no torch relay. Alessandro Libri, a Tokyo-based journalist, says that's a shame.
Japanese, obviously, they're very well organized, but to recreate the sort of missing Olympic spirit, which is the essence of every game, is going to be very difficult.
The big question is, how much will anyone care? Amid a still-raging pandemic, there are signs global interest is lacking for what some media have already labeled the no-fun Olympics. Only 46% of global respondents said they were interested in the Tokyo Olympics, according to an Ipsos poll. Underlying it all is worry the Games will serve as a super-spreader event in Tokyo, which remains in a state of emergency after a spike in COVID-19 cases. Already, three Olympic athletes have tested positive, prompting a wave of negative headlines, says Libri.
It wasn't supposed to be like this. Every Olympics also brings on head some sort of critical voices, but we are on a different level now, and it's 3-4 days to go.
Organizers hope that once the competition begins, the attention will shift away from the pandemic. But that may be tough. Jack Tarrant is a freelance journalist in Tokyo. He says media access to athletes will be very restricted due to COVID-19 protocols.
We don't get the allowed to get close to them, to get to know them, to get to know their personal stories, which is what the Olympics is all about. Instead, it's going to be fairly formulaic. It's going to be video conference interviews.
To create more connections with viewers, organizers are relying on technology. Fans can post video selfies that will appear on giant screens in the stands. They can also click cheer online and have their digital applause appear on broadcasts and video boards in stadium. Athletes who finish their competition will be able to interact with friends and family back home via video messaging. But a lot of that has already been tried in sports leagues around the world and fallen flat, says Tarrant.
It's nowhere near the same. And I think the Olympics might struggle even more on that front because, unlike with top sports in the U.S., for example, fans don't tend to be as passionate about a specific team or about a specific person. The Olympics, lots of people who watch the Olympics are viewing it very, very casually and are therefore probably going to be less than impressed watching it in empty venues where it's going to appear a little bit flat.
The most normal part of the Olympics could be the opening ceremony, which will likely include familiar elements such as the Parade of Nations, high-profile musical performances, and pyrotechnics. But even that event will look different. Only 1,000 VIPs are expected to attend the ceremony. That means the vast majority of the 68,000 seats will lie empty in the $1.4 billion Olympic Stadium, which was built with this very event in mind. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
VOA will have additional coverage of the 2020 Olympic Games on the sunny side of sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 UTC. And finally, looking ahead to the Games in 2032, the International Olympic Committee has awarded the Olympic and Paralympic Games to Brisbane, Australia. That's going to do it for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.